This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. Let me begin by asking this. How can we become more engaged in these important conversations about race? What can we do to create the kinds of spaces necessary for fruitful dialogue?
What we can do is have opportunities like you are having today to host lectures and conversations and town hall meetings where people come together to talk about these issues and not be afraid to approach them head on. Not be afraid to go into public spaces and talk to the other. To be in communities where you decide, let me buy my neighbor a $2.25 cup of coffee that doesn't look like me, so that I have an opportunity to engage in a conversation with them and dispel my fears. Part of what I shared with you is that I think that we mistaken racism for fear. Most people aren't racist. They're afraid of the other. They're afraid of the unknown.
Thank you. Can you name some contemporary authors who are addressing issues of race in an insightful and productive manner?
That's a hard one. I'm challenged by responding to that in an insightful manner, because I think that so many are writing from such personal perspectives around the issues of race, where I would say that there are some great things that have been written by, let's say, Cornel West. I would also argue that there are some things that have not been so well written by Cornel West. There's not anything that I would thoughtfully recommend for anyone to buy at this time, other than my book that'll come out in November. Beacon Press.
Another question from the audience. Some people in the Black Lives Matter movement strongly object to the All Lives Matter response, believing that once again, black concerns are being co-opted by the white world. What is your response to this? Do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement has any worth, any validity?
I understand and recently had a conversation with some of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. I have two observations with regards to it. Certainly the Black Lives Matters movement matters because the loss of black lives matter. The fact that it works in isolation for me becomes the challenge. I have a theory regarding the Black Lives Matter movement. I want to be a millennial, but I guess I'm too old for that. So I'm from this Generation X or something. And then there's the civil rights movement. And I think that we've missed something called what I'm calling now and defined as a gap generation that's connected more to a black power movement that has constructed itself as an isolated group of people that is only interested within itself, and thinking that in order for us to be effective, we must concentrate solely on ourselves to get this done for ourselves, by ourselves, because we only matter to ourselves, without understanding that the civil rights movement and the fight for equality was not an isolated movement that was founded by African Americans for African Americans. If you look at the history of the NAACP and the Urban League, for instance, it was the resources and the support of a Jewish woman that was the catalyst for the NAACP. Julius Rosenwald was the back support for the Urban League. So to isolate yourselves into a group to say, we have to do this for ourselves, is the starting place of wrong. So it cannot be Black Lives Matter for just black lives. You must look at a larger context of all lives mattering. You also have to look at what does the movement represent? What is it about? What are the goals and the objectives and the outcomes? And as I said to one of the leaders last week, tell me what are your goals and your objectives and your outcomes beyond rage and anger. I would join your movement if your movement represented going to Ferguson and sitting in on a police station saying we're having a sit-in, like we sat in on lunch counters in the 60s to integrate lunch counters. I would join your movement if you said, we're going to go to the Department of Justice and we're going to sit in on the Department of Justice for 30 days until we change public policy around policing. What are you doing other than rage and outrage? I mean, I certainly understand that when people lose voice and they have no place to express themselves, that they must find a way to express themselves. If you put me on the west side of Baltimore where no one cares about me on the west side of Baltimore, where the elected officials in Baltimore are actually African American, and my councilman is African American, and I don't hear from my own African American councilman, then I must have some kind of outrage, and that outrage is, I'm going to make you hear me, and if a news camera won't come to my community because I want to have a press conference on the block and the only way to get me there is to burn down the CVS, then yes, that's what I'll do. But that's not really effective. So your movement must be effective. And I think the way to make the movement effective is to say, what matters? The loss of life or the value of life? And so the Black Lives Matter movement is more about the loss of life as opposed to the value of life. How do we turn it to the value of life? And that's where my concern is.
Thank you. Thank you. That was very well said. Can a conversation reverse the effects of hundreds of years of racial stereotyping?
I don't think a conversation can reverse the effects, but I think a conversation can begin to reverse the effects. I think that we have to begin to talk, to hear each other, and to learn that these conversations not will only affect our consciousness, but will affect our children's consciousness. I have the pleasure now of having a 3-month-old, an 11-month-old who will be 12, will be a year old on next Friday. I've had him for 3 months now. And I notice how he listens to my conversations. I notice how he's learning from the things that I say. What are our children and our grandchildren learning from what we say? Maybe the conversation will not affect you, but maybe it'll affect 2 to 3 generations from now, which is where we need real impact.
Thank you. Another question from the audience. Few people talk about classism or class struggle in America, but isn't this inextricably tied to racism and just as important to discuss? And how does gender fit into this?
Certainly class and gender are major issues when you talk about race inequality. There's a couple of ways to go with that. Class definitely distinguishes how one experiences racism. I can say to you that I have been fortunate through education and through my family of origin to be a part of a different socioeconomic status, which has in some ways minimized what I've experienced around racism. But yet at the same time, it remains true and apparent. But it definitely plays a large factor in what you experience. As it relates to the issues of gender, certainly women remain oppressed, and we know that they still make 25 cents less on a dollar than men. So that's one dynamic that we still need to address and to deal with in this country. As it relates to the LGBTQ rights, we see certainly an emergence of equality that is happening every day. So there are lots of things that we are seeing progress on, but we have a long ways to go, and it is certainly the catalyst of the civil rights movement that has had great impact on the success and the quality of life for women as well as the LGBTQ community.
Another audience member comments, I'm here because we are a white community. How do we get people to care and talk about these issues when we see no one of a different color in our midst?
Bust them in. You have to find ways to integrate your space. You have to find a way to bring the other in, to be a part of who you are and what you're doing and how you're doing it. I would be delighted to invite my church from Dorchester to come to one of your lectures next year on a Sunday morning, to be here as a part of any conversation that you have so that you can experience the other. Something like that.
Would you advocate for us to go there as well?
Absolutely. You're welcome.
Good idea.
I think that that's one of the ways to do it, to figure out ways to integrate spaces that become comfortable first and then uncomfortable second. Can I share one thing? I was with Stephanie Meeks, who is the president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. We went to North Philadelphia to visit the Joe Lewis Gym because of some preservation work that I've done. And so we went in a car, and she said, release the car, we'll get a taxi out. And I said, Stephanie, we're in North Philadelphia. She said, oh, we're fine, we'll get a taxi out. I said, okay. So we released the car to get a taxi out. So about 45 minutes later, we're standing on North Broad Street waiting for a taxi. No taxi came. And so Stephanie was there. She had about 5-carat diamond ring on her finger and standing in North Philadelphia. And I said to her, we're not going to get a taxi out of here. We'll get a jitney. Anybody knows what a jitney is? So it's like a community car service where you find someone along the road that'll take you for $5. And so I said, we'll find a jitney. Walk with me a couple of blocks to find a jitney. So we walked for a couple of blocks. And as we're crossing the street, there are these kids on the street who look like total thugs. Total thugs. And so having been a pastor in an urban community, I relate to everybody. So I said, what's up, guys? And they say, what's up? And you could see Stephanie freeze. And they kept walking. I said, you all okay? They said, yeah, we're fine. Anyway, they came back, shorten the story. They came back and began a conversation with us to share that they were music artists. They graduated from high school. They were trying to get their CD released. And on the corner in North Philadelphia, Stephanie Meeks transformed. They were afraid of her, and she was afraid of them. And she's now supporting these three artists in their work. And the element on that corner in North Philadelphia, which I wouldn't advise her to go to without me, to get a jitney, was fear. So how do we create the space for the other to dispel our fears?
Thank you. We've got time for just one more question. It's been said that current American Christianity emphasizes God's love for all, but largely ignores or downplays our need to respond to racism by practicing love for all of God's creation. If so, are the organized churches responsible in large measure for the continued presence of racism and inequality? We thought we'd throw you a hardball for the last question.
So the short answer is yes. I think that the church has a long way to go to represent this radical Jew with dreadlocks from Nazareth that understood when he went into the synagogue at 13 and picked up the Torah to read what he truly represented. He said that he had come for those who were bruised and oppressed and come to set at liberty those who were captive, that his message was a message of love. When he's questioned about all of the laws, the statutes and the commands as a Jew, of course, you know, Jesus was a Jew, not a Christian. When he's questioned by that, what is the greatest of them all? He says to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind. And he said the second is as great as the first, to love thy neighbor as thyself. And on these two, to crucify, sacrifice, hang, martyr, all the laws and all the prophets. And that was the mandate that he left for what we call the church. So when the church truly understands its commission, then I think it will have truly done its work.